Hello and welcome to the Healthcare Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Healthcare Podcast, where we bring you the topics, insights, thought leaders, and discussions that may just change the way you think about healthcare. In today's episode, we're going to talk about philosophy, public utility, and why healthcare is much easier to save than we think. How do we define healthcare? Is it defined as a set of moral imperatives that each person operating in a symbiotic system prescribes to in order to enable the caretaking of individuals in need of caring? Or is it more a web of self-interested parties working to maximize their economic slice of the pie on the back of one of the most inelastic services there is? Maybe it's somewhere in between. Regardless, I think it's easy to agree that something or many things are not right in our healthcare system. Patients going bankrupt over bills, insurers denying life-saving treatments, people rationing insulin, the highest spending with the worst outcomes compared to all other peer nations. Two questions are always worth asking. Why have we come to this? And what should we do about it? To help answer those questions, today I am joined by Dr. John Silver. Dr. Silver received his associate degree in nursing in 1984 from Palm Beach Community College, his BSN from Florida Atlantic University in 1998, and his master's degree from FAU in 2000. He earned the public intellectual PhD in comparative studies from FAU in 2010. Dr. Silver started in healthcare in 1974 and became a respiratory therapist in 1978. After receiving his ADN nursing degree in 1984, he worked exclusively in critical care, including medical and surgical ICUs, trauma units, burn units, and neurological ICUs. He spent the last 8 years of practice in emergency rooms while attaining his degrees and then transitioning into academia. Dr. Silver writes and speaks about political issues in nursing and healthcare. He has presented at multidisciplinary conferences, both nationally and internationally, on health policy, the restructuring of healthcare systems using the public utility model, and the role of nursing in that process. He has also spoken to a variety of nurse practitioner groups on political tactics for prescriptive authority and independent practice. In 2004, he led Spectrum's international online chat prior to the election. He also studied nursing theory, nursing leadership, and has a particular interest in the political fracturing of nursing. In 2013, he published his book on political empowerment, Just a Union of Nurses. Welcome to the show, John, and thanks so much for being here.
Preston, it's a real pleasure to be here. I can't wait for this discussion.
I am very excited. As someone who dabbled in the philosophical arts in my undergraduate degree and have a bookshelf full of unread philosophy books, I am very excited to crack into some of the philosophical aspects of this. So I've heard a little bit, we've connected before, but I'd love for you to share a little bit more just about your background. It's a really fascinating one. You've traveled all over the world and studied healthcare systems. So just would love to hear about kind of your background from your own words and some of those travel experiences in studying different healthcare systems.
Sure. Well, when you read it out like that, it sounds like I've been really busy since 1974. Really, you know, for almost 20 years, I just watched the world go by through a window of a hospital. And I was working a lot. And I was pretty much just minding my own business. When I decided in the 90s that, you know, nursing was my career. I really loved being a registered nurse. And so I should go back and get my bachelor's. And there I got exposed to a lot of nurses that were coming back. And they were all complaining about the same things I'd complained about 20 years prior to that. So it started getting me thinking, you know, why can't nursing solve these problems? So at first I thought it was kind of an image thing. People just didn't know what we did. But by the end of the bachelor's, I was pretty convinced it was a political problem. So I did a master's degree with a focus on health policy and went up and did two internships in Congress. I attended a class at George Mason University's Health Policy Institute, and then came back and worked with a Florida rep for a while, although that was pretty futile. So when I did my master's project, I did it on how do you use media, proactive media utilization. How does any groups, even small groups, how can you use media to accomplish your goals? And so I published that. And then I decided, well, you know, I'd already been started talking at that point, but it was always me up there and then a light round of applause because I was a nurse. And then this, you know, ovation for the doctor that knew nothing about health policy walking up and talking. So I said, all right, you know what? I got to get a doctorate. Well, there's already a lot of really smart nurses with PhDs, public health people. Nobody had really been able to solve this problem. So as I started my coursework through this, I think it was a brilliant PhD program, a little challenging for a nurse too, I think, not just a nurse, but I've been siloed in my own discipline and now I'm in a multidisciplinary PhD program. I started running this program in the back of my head of what's wrong with healthcare and how do we fix this thing? So I decided that since everybody else had gone through these silos of academia, nobody was really coming out with much, that I'd try it kind of almost like a philosopher. How would a philosopher solve this problem? I thought. And I'd always admired Socrates. So I started running this program in the back of my head. And the first task for me was coming up with the goals. If you don't have goals of where you're trying to go, what you're trying to do, how do you know what you, where you want to go, and where you want to be, you know?
Yeah.
So I wrote out, it took a while, 7 goals, I thought, for a healthcare system. I then was at the, you know, from 2006 to 2010, I was very fortunate. I went to Argentina for 10 days, studied their system, got to talk to a ton of people and experts down there in healthcare. Then I went over in 2009 and gave a talk to actually a design conference on how do you design a healthcare system. Then I went to UCLA and talked to another international group on technology, knowledge, and society, which was very interesting. And I've been to a couple of conferences other than that, but each place I went, oh, I also went to Cardiff, Wales for the first STTI conference where I had all the European nurses coming in, which was really great discussion. So I came back and I took all the models I could find around the world, including, you know, especially the ones I'd been able to directly examine. And I put them on the table to see, okay, which one of you guys meets the goals? And as it turned out, none of them did. And our system didn't meet any of the 7 goals. So that was pretty obvious to me. And then a gentleman by the name of Avetis Donabedian had postulated about systems and organizations. And his conclusion was that the system really controls the processes and the processes control the outcomes. So if you looked at the outcomes for U.S. healthcare, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, almost 1 out of every 2 U.S. adults, over 107 million people, have at least 1 of 6 chronic diseases, a lot of which are preventable.
Yeah.
So this is pointing to an absolute lack of preventative and primary care services for people. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the system we have out there, you see that huge swaths of this country have very limited access to, you know, anything from dentistry to mental health services to even basic healthcare services. 7 out of 10 deaths in Americans are from chronic diseases. Again, a lot of them preventable. Mm-hmm. Diabetes, leading cause of kidney failure, lower limb amputations, and blindness in 20 to 74-year-olds. We're now seeing type 2 diabetes in 8 and 9-year-old children. That used to be called adult onset diabetes. Right. Over 13 million people with COPD. 1 in 3 U.S. adults, 63 million people have hypertension. Mm-hmm. Nearly 70% of the first heart attacks and 77% of strokes are people that are hypertensive. So I started doing some research on this and came across a group called the Commonwealth Foundation. And they actually did analysis of all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And their conclusions are kind of devastating, I think. They basically show that we need to reevaluate the structure of how healthcare is organized, delivered, prioritized, and incentivized. Well, that's pretty much the entire system,
yeah. Right?
They want to strengthen primary care. They want to start addressing prevention of chronic diseases that we're having a problem. We spend more than anybody else in the world. Mm-hmm. We have the worst outcomes of all the OECD countries. We've got these huge rise in suicides, and there's just, and then COVID hit. That's all pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And then COVID hit, and I think it really showed us that this fractionized healthcare system we have of all these independent for-profit centers. We're basically just skimming along on razor thin edges of personnel, supplies, all that stuff, because they're trying to maximize profits. And then when they got hit, these companies that were relying on like per diem nurses and agency nurses, those nurses didn't want to go in there and deal with that. So, you know, they ended up paying exorbitant salaries to try to get nurses to come in. That worked a little bit.
Right.
So here we are in 2021. We have this healthcare mess that's out there. It impacts all of us. It's not just impacting African Americans. It's not just impacting Hispanic Americans or white Americans or Democrat Americans or Republican Americans. We're all paying way too much for this stuff, mm-hmm. and we're getting lousy outcomes. So at what point does a society sit down and say, you know, enough's enough?
Yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, I think that's a really, you know, maybe for 20 years you watch the world go by, but I got to imagine incredible insider experience. And then to go out of that environment and on that type of journey, I mean, it's very incredible to hear about that you've been able to look around globally, because I think we look around globally to compare a lot, but we don't necessarily look around globally for solutions. And I think that's one of the reasons I was so excited to speak with you, is because a lot of people with a lot of opinions, but less solutions for kind of what the problem is. And listen, they might not all be the best, or they might be messy, but you know, to hear and be able to talk about something tangible that I think has some legs is really great to be able to do. Yeah.
And if you look around at what's going on, all these innovation groups and hackathons and, you know, disruptors and all this stuff, really what they're dealing with is the process level. Mm-hmm. And the process level, unfortunately, is dictated by the system. And if you try to funnel all this stuff through this for-profit insurance-based system,
right,
the chances of really accomplishing anything are pretty small.
Yeah. In your opinion, you know, going up to that sort of system level, knowing sort of the evolution of healthcare, how insurers came to be, you know, the genesis of paying for healthcare, when healthcare was really, you're going to go to the hospital probably to die because you had terrible, you know, hygiene practices and surgeries were just, you know, cutting off limbs pretty much. And, you know, as medicine progressed, we had this insurance model, and maybe our incentives became misaligned somewhere along the path. Do you think that our system design, because I've talked to a lot of people about it, and they say the system is working just as it was designed to work. So we say healthcare is broken, but that's kind of perhaps not true. It's actually working. It's just designed poorly. Do you think that it is an intentional design, or that we just have sort of ended up here as a result of evolution, some pod policies over time that stuck and put a few people in power and high profits? Or do you really think there's some sort of like master plan design behind our system that has, you know, thrown us into this kind of, you know, high cost, low outcome circumstance?
Yes, no, yes, yes, and no. No, seriously. I mean, I started in 74. At that time, a lot of the hospitals were privately owned, doctors owned them. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that made money in hospitals were doctors. And especially in the 60s, when specialization and ICUs and all that stuff, you know, all their salaries started going way up. Mm-hmm. Physicians were increasingly incentivized to be specialists. And then you kind of watch what happened in the 70s to 80s. And I think corporate America woke up to the fact that, hey, there's a lot of money in this gig. Mm-hmm. And they started buying up the systems and taking over the systems. And yes, this system reflects the corporate design to maximize profit at every level and to not do things that do not generate profit. So putting a facility in the middle of a rural area where you've got, you know, maybe what, 10,000 people within 30 miles of you is just not profitable. You can't put a full service hospital in there and expect to make money. And so, you know, we're seeing the collapse of those systems now across the country. And it's been an interesting transition to watch physicians that were largely in control of what was going on in the practice area to suddenly having DRGs put in under Reagan, which would tell them things like, well, you can keep this patient for 2 days, but if you keep them for 3 days, it's going to cost you money. They started putting the emphasis on the facilities to control these things. And so what you saw almost, you know, immediately in the mid 80s was this real rapid escalation of throughput into facilities and doctor's offices, because they had to, you know, see 35, 40 patients a day to generate enough money out of the insurance reimbursements. And when you do that, you deprive people of the full scope of what, you know, medicine and nursing should be able to bring, which is education and try to work toward prevention and give people strategies and do nutritional consults. And we don't evaluate living areas anymore. A lot of medicine and nursing now is just focused on this patient in this facility in this bed with this problem. Mm-hmm. We're not looking at how did they end up here? How do we keep other people from ending up here?
Right.
So we've lost a lot of this social context in healthcare because everything now is generated by this profit focus without, again, any kind of perspective of community health, state health, global health, national health, anything.
Right. Yeah, I think we probably both agree that the public health system in the U.S. could use a lot of work and substantially more funding and focus.
Well, they've been gutted for 30 years. They've been the whipping post of all the administrations as they've tried to cut back budgets since the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the perspective people have is that, oh, they just monitor STDs, you know, sexually transmitted diseases.
Yeah.
They do a lot more than that. And when you've gutted them, they don't have the staff or the capacity to do any of this stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned you know, the design of healthcare not currently meeting the needs of, you know, the U.S. population, and then you also mentioned 7 goals for the healthcare. Can you explain a little bit more about what those 7 goals are and kind of how our design is not meeting them?
Sure. So the 7 goals I talked about. The first one is equitable access appropriate to a community's needs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems kind of self-obvious to me. And yet our system is nowhere close to that.
Mm.
And we have huge community areas that just have very little access to healthcare at all. I thought the second goal should be quality evidence-based care. Okay.
Right.
By some estimates, it takes 15 to 17 years to get evidence practice down to the level of actual care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
That's absurd.
Yeah.
Equitable, targeted, and evidence-based distribution of resources. In other words, if we're going to spend money somewhere, it should be fairly done. We should be putting the resources in that that community needs, and we should have evidence, for example, public health information of why we're doing that.
Right.
I thought the administration and facilities, all health care facilities, need to change. We need to have interdisciplinary, practitioner-led administration, so that the system is congruent with the values of medicine and nursing, which are, you know, pretty much to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought that they should then be allowed to maximize their skill sets. So for whether you look at nurse practitioners or physical therapists or, you know, these people are trained to do stuff and then we handicap them and don't let them do it. I thought there should be equitable and positive outcomes. You come into healthcare, you should expect that, you know, you're not going to get an accident or sepsis or something else that's going to kill you a month down the road. What was that study in Lancet that said that healthcare is now the third leading cause of death in our country? I thought there should be cost efficiency. I'm tired. I've watched history a lot, and just sit there and throw money at problems does nothing. There should be efficiency in healthcare and what they're doing. A lot of tests we know are just basically useless, and they're done a lot of times by providers to have overwhelming evidence to justify what they're doing so they don't end up in court.
Yeah.
And then finally, I thought there should be social accountability in the healthcare systems and a mandate that these systems directly report to the public they serve. on the problems we're facing, the issues in communities, and how we can work together to start addressing this. So if you look at the U.S. system, we do not have equitable access appropriate to community needs. We do not have quality evidence-based care. We don't have an equitable distribution of resources. We don't have an interdisciplinary group leading the healthcare. We don't have equitable and positive outcomes. We don't have cost efficiency, and there's no social accountability. So again, our whatever this thing is, and I hesitate to even call it a system, it doesn't meet any of those goals.
Yeah. No, I mean, no, I don't think that it does either. And I'm sure that, you know, we could make the argument that some areas, some people, some groups are doing the right things. But yeah, if we talk about it on a system level, I mean, we're not even close. And the evidence is pretty overwhelming to support that. So
we do have centers of excellence in this country. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
The problem is we don't have very many of them.
Right. And if you want to talk about centers of excellence as it relates to access, if we look at some of the top tier centers of excellence places in the country that are doing, you know, providing the best of whatever and who they're providing it to, that becomes usually a pretty glaring, you know, indictment from an access perspective.
Yeah.
But, okay. So we have this, these seven goals and we know that we're not doing it. And so I'm excited to jump in and hear from you, you know, this solution that you came up with, the public utility model or the hybrid public utility model of, you know, something that really could impact and change our healthcare system and to meet these goals and really revolutionize things. Can you talk a little bit about what that model is?
Sure. So I put all these models on the table and they all just came off because none of them met these goals. There's a couple of caveats in the United States you have to kind of take into account. One is the state-federal divide. So we're a federated republic. There's states have power. The federal government has power, which is why I chose state-based regional systems as the setup instead of a national system. The other thing you have to avoid is the socialism trap. I'm sick of that word. People use it and they don't even know what it means. Mm-hmm. But it is a political hot button. And if they can paint you as being, you know, like Medicare for All is just going to be painted as socialism, you immediately are going to have 40 to 50% of this country hate it. So it just becomes a political nightmare. So I asked three questions initially, and one of them is that we have not had a discussion of nationally. The first question is healthcare a right or a privilege? We have not been able to have that debate in this country. The second thing is, what do we want the healthcare system to do? Do we want it to be compassionate, understand futility and all this stuff, and, you know, use palliative care and hospice care when appropriate? Or do we want a healthcare system that chases the last RBC around your body? And then third, what responsibility do we have as a public to maintain our own health? There's plenty of information out there. We've known since the 60s, eat a balanced diet, get exercise. And all that sounds kind of easy, but as we've changed socially, particularly in the 90s, more and more jobs are sedentary sitting at computer screens. And that's probably the worst thing you can do for your physical health. And it's also led to the explosion in obesity since the 80s. So I went back and I asked U.S. history, okay, when have we had a big issue where we weren't willing to call it a right, but it was too important to be just a privilege to some? And I found the electrical issue in the 20s. So I studied that and the history of that coming out of, you know, the natural monopoly theory in England in the 1880s when it was brought over here. And I looked at FDR's work setting up the public utility system. And I said, okay, let me take the public utility model and I'll put it on the table and see if that works. And it turned out as long as I changed two of the variables, it works brilliantly. And it works right down to the street level. Mm-hmm. By my estimate, in this model, we'd save 42% in cost and healthcare in this country. Everybody would still pay, but we'd pay a lot less than we're paying now. And we'd have a much more aggressive system in terms of prevention and primary care availability and integrated, you know, healthcare facilities, things like that. So the public utility model has meets all seven of these goals.
Got it. Okay, so what does it, what does that look like though? So what is the public utility? I think we all have a good sense for like how our electricity works, and we all have, you know, kind of one, we have, I'm in Georgia, Georgia Power, you know, does electricity, and it's, you know, kind of that public private kind of thing going on. We pay for it based on what we use. But so how does that then apply to healthcare? Are we paying just out of pocket, but it's much less? Is it all through taxable system? I mean, what's the overall structure? I'm assuming that it affects specialists and primary care is maybe different. I mean, what's the like nuts and bolts of how it looks?
Well, there's different levels, obviously. So from the person level, living in a house, I was working on doing a commercial where you show a guy walk out and he looks at his utility bills and he sees, you know, water, electricity, healthcare. Mm-hmm. And then you hear a scream. His daughter fell down, broke her leg. She goes to the hospital. They come back. They're walking in and the wife turns around and goes, you know, we're a little short this month. How much did that cost us? And he looks over and he goes, nothing. And then you have another one, the same exact commercial, but it's not on that public, you know, the public utility bill. And when they're walking back in, he's saying, well, there was a $300 copay and we have a $750 deductible. So it's going to cost us somewhere around $1,000. And the wife just starts hanging her head down going, we don't have that money. So I think that kind of shows dramatically how this would work out at a individual level. Yes, maybe you'd have a $75 bill for healthcare on your utility monthly. But you're not paying copays, you're not paying deductibles, you're not paying specialists, you're not paying Part B Medicare for hidden charges with radiologists in India reading your thing. You don't have any of that nonsense anymore. And I think what people have to understand, you know, there's this perception that if we do something like that, everybody's going to go running to hospitals and doctors. Who likes to go to the doctor? Who wants to be admitted to a hospital? Oh, great. There may be a very small minority of people
sure, who
enjoy this, but the vast majority of us don't want anything to do with doctors and hospitals unless we have to. But to have that availability that you can take your kids in, get them treated at a pediatrician, get their vaccinations, do all that stuff, and you're not going to walk out $250 poorer. Mm-hmm. You mentioned bankruptcies early. Over half the bankruptcies in this country are healthcare related.
Right, yeah.
Look at the people that have to set up GoFundMe things so that they can pay for their chemotherapy.
Right. Drug. They can't. Yeah. It's,
this is absurd in this country. Absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Now at the macro level, the design is, like I said, the functional unit would be the state-based interdisciplinary regional councils.
Okay.
I would put them in teaching hospitals. So those are usually hospitals associated with universities. The reason I put them there is I want a direct relationship to the universities, to the healthcare oversight, so that we can start bringing evidence-based practice into practice at a reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
The other tie-ins to that group would be public health. So public health would be sitting at that table. EMS would be sitting at that table.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have somebody from the governor's office at that table. We're not, healthcare people aren't, in, you know, we're not an enforcement agency. I can't force anybody to do anything. So all these groups, physical therapy, nutritionists, occupational therapists, long-term care people, they'd all be at this council table. And we would make decisions about where resources are going to be allocated, how things are going to be done. From that state-based regional council, it would then spread out to the large hospitals, the ones that are, I would call full service facilities. They would also have geographic areas that they're accountable for, all the clinics, long-term care facilities. They would also have interdisciplinary councils leading them. I would keep the main state base, the main council, also in charge of the rural areas directly.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that's important is that that council needs to keep a holistic view of healthcare in their region. And one of the ways you do that is to force that central council to look out at the state and look out at areas that don't have a lot of maybe economic prosperity or access to resources, so that we could really get innovation in there to bring services to these areas. Nationally, there would also be a council, also interdisciplinary. I'd put it in HHS, but I'd take it away from direct political oversight. Mm-hmm. This council would then integrate with all the state-based regional councils to look for things like best practices, so that we could disseminate this information out to other places that may have similar challenges. Another huge advantage of this system is the regional systems can cooperate with each other because they're not competitive. They can cooperate in buying equipment so we can get reductions in medical equipment costs. They can also, and this is interesting, lower drug costs. And since Congress seems incapable of allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices, these regions could join together and say, no, we're not going to pay for this. Mm-hmm. We're going to negotiate drug prices on our own. There's not one pharmaceutical corporation in the world that would pull out of the U.S. market. We are the largest consumers of everything, drugs. So who's going to pull out? What, Pfizer going to say, well, I'm not going to sell, you know, unless I can charge $1,400 for this pill, I'm not going to sell any? Yeah, baloney.
Right.
We could also respond and help each other. So if a swath of tornadoes goes through northern Kansas, regional systems in the area, even from other states, can come in and try to help and bring resources to bear. Just like we see in hurricanes when electrical companies come down to Florida to help. It's this sense of a cooperative, integrative network that's going to dramatically change healthcare.
And so are the private hospitals, private systems staying private? Are they all becoming, you know, a public?
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, something that people kind of go, ooh, can you even do that? Well, we did it in the 30s when we went to all these electric companies around the country that were charging whatever they wanted and putting electricity wherever they wanted. And we said, no, this is going to be your new administrative structure. So that's how we address this too. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a transition, I'm sure, by corporations like Tenet and HCA out of this model. Mm-hmm. Good. You're doing a lousy job anyway. So it would be first the federal legislation through probably Medicare saying that if you want Medicare dollars and you want to deliver healthcare, this is what your administrative structure has to look like. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the easy way to do it. The states, on the other hand, would need to set up the regional systems. Okay. So I think with overwhelming public demand that we do something, all of this is, you know, fairly easy legislatively.
Mm-hmm. And then what happens to, we all know that there's a lot of administrative extras, middlemen, GPOs, and, you know, big buying groups, and, you know, just a lot of layers that just add costs and costs and costs. And then you take, I'm assuming we don't need insurance companies anymore. So
not for health.
You're right. So, I mean, if we looked at the total output economically of that, those industries, you said 42%. So that's what, $1.5 trillion. What, I mean, do you think there's going to be a lot of people who would say, what, you just erased $1.5 trillion of economics? I mean, what happens?
I don't know. Ask the blacksmiths how they felt when the car got invented. I don't, you know, people are, if you're a computer person for an insurance company, there's going to be computer jobs in healthcare still. There's mm-hmm. going to be data analysts, public health will pick up people. It's not like we're going to, you know, take, I don't know, 4 million people and throw them out in the street and say, tough luck. They're going to have to adapt to the new system design. People are going to, some of them, particularly medical specialists, are going to take a hit in pay. But, you know, do we really want to be in a situation like, I know almost 70% of physicians now are employees. They're working as employees for somebody. Right, so the era of the go set up your own shingle and run your own practice is really getting brutalized. Those physicians, you know, I know one doctor, he makes $545,000 a year for his practice, But the stipulation for that was he had to see somewhere around 40 patients a day. So these facilities are paying him lots of money, but the throughput on these patients is just outrageous. And how do you deliver, you know, quality care in 10 minutes?
Yeah.
How do you get to know somebody and understand the, you know, the pushes and pulls in their lives?
Mm-hmm.
So healthcare is much more than here, take this pill, see you in a month. We have to restore that level of personal in healthcare while we're keeping the focus on the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I don't disagree. It's something I've come back to or spoken with people or wrestled with, especially, I guess, you know, this wouldn't necessarily be an overnight change and industries evolve.
Preston, let me ask you a question.
Yeah, yeah.
I was on a radio show one time and I had called in and there was some expert in healthcare and I kind of started talking about this and his comment to me was, well, the executives in healthcare would never agree to this. We spend $3.5 trillion in healthcare in this country. Are we doing that to keep a bunch of executives happy?
Well, yeah.
While we're getting really crappy outcomes, is our concern that we somehow readjust, you know, that a bunch of insurance 25-year-olds that are declining your services are going to have to, you know, find other jobs? Yeah, but is that warrant keeping this dysfunctional system in place? I don't think it does. And I think people will have to take skills that they have and adapt them to other areas, either within healthcare or other, you know, corporate systems.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you. I was, you know, there's been evolutions across all industries, every industry. I mean, you know, when printing on paper started, I mean, you know, everything evolves and changes over time. And not having to have insurance companies be the gatekeepers for our healthcare should be an evolution, and that'll just, we'll have to figure it out as we go down that path for, you know, a better, more evolved, equitable, better outcome healthcare system.
Or you can give tax breaks to people to go get different certifications. So mm-hmm. But to sit there and maintain a system that's causing this much havoc in this country, financially, socially, and, you know, economically, and to sit there and keep it because we're afraid to go in and do something because it might tick off some computer users in the insurance industry or some executive that's making, you know, $12 million to run a hospital. I have no pity. You know, things change over time. You have to be able to adapt.
Yeah. And it's something that I don't see a lot of people talk about. I've seen it here and there, but you kind of touched on it, is the economic impact of the healthcare system. It's like, yeah, we have the healthcare economy, $3.8 trillion. It's going to be $4.5 trillion in no time if we don't do anything about it. But then we don't necessarily talk about, well, what's the economic impact of someone who develops diabetes and can't access care and then develops a diabetic foot ulcer and then has to have an amputation. And then it's like, oh, well, that costs the healthcare system a lot. It's like, yeah, but that also takes a person out of being a productive member of the economy. If you just want to talk about it in terms of, like, you know, pure economics,
productivity,
right. And kind of reduce it down to that, you know, and I think people miss that a lot, is that by having a dysfunctional, super expensive healthcare system, we are handicapping the economy.
Oh yeah, the loss in productivity is in the, you know, $100 billion range every year from just, you know, absences and sicknesses and all that stuff. But I want to kind of clarify the public utility thing in the sense that
I love
this quote from FDR when he was talking about the public utility model, and he said that it was a birch rod that would be kept in the closet, only used when the child gets beyond the point where a mere scolding does no good. Yeah, we had the 1999 Institute of Medicine report that showed that we were killing somewhere between 100 and 200,000 people in our healthcare system. A lot of them downstream, sepsis, all this other stuff, you know, caudies, the catheter infections, central line infections, ventilator infections, all this stuff. So we had this big report came out, and in the decade after that, healthcare systems basically did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the Lancet report come out. And the Lancet report's talking about, you know, over, you know, somewhere around 300,000 people a year that are dying from this either unavailability of healthcare, the incompetence of healthcare, the burdens of these diagnostics that are being done on people, which a lot of them are not benign. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, I always try to tell people this, you know, a CT angiography of your brain is the equivalent of 60 chest x-rays of radiation. The American Academy of Pediatrics just came out, I think last year, and told ER docs, stop CTing kids' brains just because they fall down.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, the ER docs are going, listen, if I don't do this and that, you know, one in 75,000 kids has an intracranial bleed, I'm going to be sued out of my brains. Right. So, you know, we have to start looking at stuff like that. You know, administration now is over 30% of healthcare costs. It's out of control. So anyway.
Yeah. No, I was talking to a doctor, a family doctor, someone who's in our family who is a doctor. And he was mentioning what happened recently, I think a few years ago in Minnesota. He was saying they would call them curbsides, which is basically just chat with another doctor about a patient that you have and say, what do you think about this? I'm running this lab. And they're like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. Or check for this, what have you. What ended up, one of those interactions, eventually the patient died from, you know, whatever complications. And then the family sued and pulled in the curbside doctor, the one who, someone in the hallway was just like, hey, I got this patient, I'm thinking about this, what have you. So yeah, I mean, I can imagine that there is a certain amount of fear in practicing medicine now, which, you know, I don't necessarily think there should be. I mean, responsibility for sure, but fear. And so you're overrunning tests and overrunning different things and overprescribing just so that you don't get in trouble is a big issue.
Yeah, in this model, medicine really controls medicine. Mm-hmm. Nursing controls nursing. PT controls PT. Pharmacists control pharmacy. But there also has to be the agreement that we're going to have much invigorated peer review. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if docs are going to be kind of more free. In other words, they're not going to have to get pre-approvals before they order this test or that test, but they are going to have to answer to other physicians, mm-hmm, as to, you know, why this patient needed 3 CAT scans in 2 weeks. I mean, there's not going to be this, you know, this doctor just orders 6,000 tests. This one orders one. They're going to be peer reviewed, mm-hmm, but by other doctors. So that process has not been done very well up till now.
Yeah.
Doctors don't like to criticize other doctors, but since they're not going to have to pay malpractice rates anymore, and since it would be the regional system that would be sued, mm-hmm, their malpractice burden is going to be determined by how well the practitioners in that region function. So they're going to have a vested interest in making sure that the right things are done. That's not questioning every order a doctor does, but it is monitoring that we're not abusing things within the healthcare system.
Yeah, no, I like that. I was going to ask about, you know, how does, if something happens and someone feels like someone needs to be sued, because we love suing people in the US, and you know, where do they point to the doctor or the, and if it can ladder up to the system, it's, you know, it almost to me increases accountability in a way, because you do have this governance that's in place, but at the same time, freeing up doctors to practice at the top of, you know, their game and what they can do to affect patients.
And if they need to spend 25 minutes with somebody, they spend 25 minutes with them.
Sure.
Yeah. And this is also going to unleash, because one of the caveats of this is we're going to have to have every state approve nurse practitioner practice, mm-hmm, independent nurse practitioner practice, because this model will just unleash innovation at the street level, where a lot of nurse practitioners are already showing that they're going. The problem is the biggest obstacle they have is the healthcare systems in the area. And so a lot of these innovative programs, whether it's Black women in maternal health, these kind of identified nursing areas of concern. But they're all being funded by things like HRSA grants and NGOs and, you know, this grant from here, the grants run out, services stop. To have all of that being integrated part of the actual healthcare system itself is really going to bring healthcare down to the street level. And we need to be in these communities as healthcare providers to build up the trust that's needed between the healthcare system and the populations that we're talking about. We've seen the impact of not having that in COVID. We were caught with our pants down in terms of contact tracing. Look at the vaccine rollout, the big complaints of, hey, you know, you have to go to the, you know, the football stadium to get a vaccine. Why aren't we doing this in clinics in the communities where people already know you, they trust you, you're sitting there as medical people saying, yeah, you need to get this. As opposed to somebody from CDC just coming and telling the country, hey, everybody has to get vaccinated.
Sure.
I think it makes a huge impact.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. And what do you think? So you just mentioned, you know, obstacles. I mean, what do you think the biggest obstacle would be for this? I mean, you're talking about a very monumental change. So, I mean, what's going to be those top hurdles? I mean, is it just going to be from a legislative, you know, politicians, the interested parties and lobbying group? I mean, is everything a hurdle? Doctors who are going to make less money, presumably, you know, what's the...
Yeah, I mean, if you look at 2019, the top five political healthcare political contributors gave over $100 million into the political system.
Yeah.
Just last year, I think Big Pharma gave $250 to $300 million into the political system. Why are they spending all that money? Mm. You know, Big Pharma put that money in because Congress started talking about letting Medicare negotiate drug prices.
Right.
And you've probably seen the ads on TV from the American Hospital Association and Big Pharma trying to convince Americans what a bad idea this is. You know, the little girl from Canada saying, you don't want our system. I couldn't get my medications. Oh, BS. So, yeah, it's going to be a battle. You know, American Hospital Association isn't going to like it. Tenet isn't going to like it. HCA isn't going to like it. Catholic Charity Hospitals aren't going to like it. But you know what? Too damn bad. You had a chance. You could have stepped up to the plate and done the right thing. You focused on money. Okay, bye. I have no pity for them at all. But their influence on legislators is going to be a huge obstacle. So if you look at, remember, I wrote the book on political empowerment. The group I studied took on all the big players and beat them. Mm-hmm. Now, how did they do that? They garnered public support.
Sure.
Because the two things politicians deal with is they need a constant stream of money coming in, but they need to be reelected.
Right.
And if you can start taking, you know, billboard ads out in these opponents to this reforms district saying, you want to know why healthcare costs so much? With a finger pointing at that politician. That's why it costs so much. And you can start garnering this red and blue support for let's do something where this is absurd. I think you're going to see the political system flip pretty quick.
Yeah. And so when to that end, I mean, what are your plans for the public utility model, your future? Like, where do we go from here? What are you working on that if people listening can get involved or learn more, get interested and, you know?
Well, I found some like-minded folks. I started doing, I kind of got mad when COVID started and seeing what was happening to, you know, my ex-coworkers and how we were just getting brutalized. And so I kind of started coming back and doing podcasts. And I did one where I connected with this nurse practitioner from Kentucky, who's she runs an integrated healthcare business of her own, cash only. And she's very holistic in what she does. And so we linked up and she'd just written a book called Transforming Healthcare. So we sort of became partners. Her name was Kim Evans. Then I met up with Kathleen Bartholomew, who's another nurse activist, TED talker, wrote a book called The Dauntless Nurse, talking about lateral violence, in healthcare and in nursing. And she was a national speaker and writer. So she kind of joined with me and we became partners. We have a podcast host, Leanne Myers, who we kind of all met through. She's working with us because she has so many contacts from her podcast. We now have Beth Haney, who is a nurse practitioner and also a councilwoman in California. In fact, she was so concerned about this that she set up a meeting with, well, not concerned, but curious, where she set up a meeting with me and her and the like associate director of the water system in Southern California, which is a public utility. And his comment at the end of the thing was, this is brilliant, you know, and we know public utilities work. We also know that in the current format, they've been kind of, a lot of them kind of corrupted over the last 40 or 50 years. And consequently, we saw the abuse of like Enron in California. We saw the collapse of the Texas public utility electrical system and the storm. And but that's because these systems have been warped. When you can look around the country and see tons of public utility systems do a pretty damn good job. The other thing I'd say about this model is there are hundreds and hundreds of examples around our country that use this direct model approach, but again, not as part of a system, that show it works. And you can go around the world. They just had an article in the New Yorker in Costa Rica, which reunited physicians with public health and had dramatically improved outcomes. So these proof of this model working is all around us. It's just not organized and integrated into our basic healthcare delivery process.
Got it. So, in your estimation, you know, the future sounds brighter for healthcare, and we can, there's something we can do about it.
Well, we formed a group called Nurses Transforming Healthcare, NTH. But there's just, you know, the five of us and two of us are retired. So we don't have tons of money to throw in things. So we did set up a website. I actually wrote a declaration of independence for nursing. And we tried to start getting some funds in, but you know, we really need to pay somebody that really knows how to do a website and get this thing up and running, because a lot of the wheels on it are missing that I want on there. And now I've done, and others, all of us in our group are reaching out to organizations. I just went out to Las Vegas and spoke to the Integrative Providers Association conference in Las Vegas. And they're now overwhelmingly adopting my model as the way to go. I'm starting to reach out on like Clubhouse, some of these other apps, because I don't even have Facebook. Okay.
You're not missing much there.
LinkedIn and email.
Yeah.
So our group is trying to get up and running. I'm connecting now with a national association called Let's Rethink This, run by a gentleman by the name of Jerry Ashton. Their primary claim to fame is repaying medical debt for people. I think they've paid over $20 million now in medical debt for people. And I just received, I'm now an ambassador for a transatlantic group that's based primarily in Europe, called the Health Captains Club. And what they're looking at is how can we use innovation to accomplish a lot of these goals for reaching out healthcare to very poor countries, to rural areas, you know, using technology so that, for example, healthcare workers in, you know, rural Arkansas can go out and, you know, collect a little bit of blood and run, I don't know, 8 blood tests right there. They don't have to have these people drive 40 miles to a lab. So how can we use innovation, in other words, to help us? With the Health Captains Club. And then the Let's Rethink This group is going to start trying to amplify our voice out there.
Got it. Wow. I mean, sounds great. Sounds like you've got a lot of work ahead of you and, you know.
But if anybody wants to help, they can either email me. It's pretty easy. Forrester2232@gmail.com. Or they can go on LinkedIn. I'm there. You can find me. John Silver, PhD, RN. Or you can go to our website, Nurses Transforming Healthcare. At least join up. I'm not asking people to throw in tons of money. Just join up so that we know you're out there somewhere. And then when we get our new website up, we'll be able to transition the names over and send out notices and all of the fancy stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'll include those links. So I was going to ask, you know, where people can find you. It sounds like those are good places to start. And you know, as this thing gets some legs and gets going, you know, very excited to see, you know, what you guys can accomplish. And, you know,
It's got to be us, Preston. It's got to be us. This is going to take all of us to do this. So, you know, young people, maybe you're not paying for health insurance, but what you're going to find pretty soon is you're going to need it. And it's unpredictable.
We pay for health insurance. We are a family of, we meet our max out of pocket every single year. We are well-versed in the entangled mess that is dealing with bills and getting overcharged and this, that, and the other thing. So,
and it's probably employer-based, right?
It is employer-based. Right.
So what happens if all of a sudden you get a horrible boss and you can't stand working there anymore?
Right. Yeah, we're in trouble.
Yeah. Do you do that calculus in your head that I've got to stay here and take this abuse because of health insurance?
We do it, and millions others do it. And it's the fact that, it, you know, healthcare is tied to your employer is
insane. So that burden gets removed.
Right.
Like, yeah. You may like it for other reasons, the pay or benefits or something else, but healthcare won't be factored in. You won't have to pay for COBRA if you change jobs.
Right.
You just go right on being covered.
Yeah. I've had COBRA too. I've done it all, man. I've been in a short time. I've got a lot of experience, the wrong kinds, with health insurance and everything else. So, and I think a lot of people have. So, I mean, I agree with you. You mentioned, I read your paper, and I think more people should read it, but about the 10th Amendment and how we kind of stop at, you know, the powers should be delegated to the state. And then we always stop there, and yet it says, or the people. And so, yes, and
so this is one thing I was thinking of doing, is getting like 100,000 people together, and we'll sue the federal government for violating our 10th Amendment rights. Right. So if you listen to like Ted Cruz or any of these people talk about the 10th Amendment, they're always using it to show state rights from gun control to abortion laws to all this other stuff that's not in the Constitution. Healthcare is not in the Constitution either. Basically, in the 1700s, they were giving you cathartics and emetics and bloodletting. So healthcare wasn't exactly the huge industry it was. But the 10th Amendment clearly says, or the people. Mm-hmm. So maybe what we need to do is have a national referendum on things like abortion, pot legalization, mandatory sentencing, felons getting their vote right back. I mean, maybe we should put this on the national stage and say, you know, Congress, here's the overwhelming voice of the American people. If you do not do this, we will sue you for violating our 10th Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I didn't know that. When I read it, I thought it was a pretty illuminating thing to see.
They always leave that clause off when they
talk. You know, selective hearing or selective, you know, choosing what you want to serve your purpose. And yeah, politicians never do that. That's not a thing that they would ever want to. Yeah.
Anyways. Well, don't do it with me because I've actually read the thing.
Well, yeah, you can't.
And the Federalist Papers and the Declaration and the Anti-Federalist Papers. So, you know, it's like they every once in a while I'll have a doctor throw up the Hippocratic Oath at me and say, you know, we're just doing the Hippocratic Oath. Yeah, well, the Hippocratic Oath says you keep all your information to yourself and don't tell anybody else. And, oh, by the way, you're not supposed to be using knives. So MDs can't be surgeons. And there's absolutely no focus on anything other than one patient at a time kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to say, I really enjoyed this. This was super interesting. I'd love to do another one and dig deeper into some of the aspects that we touched on. And you know, I'll put this up on all the socials and get the word out there. Cause I think you're onto something, definitely. And, you know, at the very least, if this leads to a groundswell of people demanding some kind of change and it's for the better, you know, I think we're on the right path. So really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us about this, and I hope to do it again.
You know, it's such a pleasure to talk about people that have knowledge in the topic area and aren't just trying to garner some kind of publicity. So I really thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you, Preston.
That's been great, John. So take care.
All right, sir. You too.
Bye-bye.